more if anyone needs. I'm so technologically it's on. Okay, so just because it's being recorded, I'm just going to introduce myself, and some of you might not have been here at the introduction session last night, so I'll just give you a little bit of background. My name is Bela Burnham, and I am originally from South Bend, Indiana, so I didn't know that there was a word Kirov. It was just what everybody did. 10 years ago, I moved to Baltimore, Maryland when I got married. My husband was learning in Near Yisrael, and we have been working at the University of Maryland for 8 years. We lived in Baltimore for a while, and then we moved to Silver Spring to be closer to College Park. So what I do is I am the director of women's programming, and I do a lot of mostly one-on-one learning. I learn with about 35 to 40 women once a week for 40-minute sessions. I do a lot of trips off campus. I feel that's really important. So I do spring break trips. I do Israel trips twice a year, which is one of the nicest parts of my job. I do off-campus Shabbatones, and I'm really passionate about empowering the women to make better life choices and build their self-esteem. So that's who I am, and what I'd like to do is really make this kind of a team effort. So what I'm going to do after we get the recording is try to type up everyone's comments so that we can have kind of a suggestion list compiled. Thank you, Rabbi Rubin. A suggestion list compiled that comes from everyone so that I can hand it out to all of you. So it's a kind of a team effort of what we're all doing. So I pass out a handout, and basically what I'm trying to do, I work in campus in particular. So Aliza, I told her it's entitled also for teens. I told Aliza that I work on campus. I've worked with teens 2 summers at camps, but anyone who has experience with teens, I'd love to hear from you because that's not my area of expertise. But Aliza asked me to direct the session specifically towards campus. So what I tried to do is on the outline and kind of have a discussion around that is try to show you, based on my experience, the best way to get students from the beginning in the door recruited to the first meeting to, God willing, seminary. So kind of going in chronological order to the different stages of growth and the different challenges that come up and hopefully ways to prevent them. But I very much want this to be, I'm just sharing my experiences, and I really want everyone to share your experiences so that I can learn from all of you. So can I just ask, how many people work on campus? Because just working through the list, that's why I thought I was going to have like 3 people because there weren't that many campus people, just so that I get an idea of how much to gear the session towards like just campus or if to broaden it out a little bit. So
we have not been working on campus, but we're transitioning to a different position within the organization next year. I will be working on campus.
Okay.
Where are you?
I'm sorry? Laura Martyr.
Where are you?
San Francisco, but we're moving to San Jose.
I mean, it doesn't have to be, like, on campus every day, but, like, working with college-age students. So most of you work with college-age students. Okay, great. Okay, great. Okay, so then you will add on the teen part. You will add on the teen part. Okay, great. Just so that I wasn't sure if I should broaden it a little bit. Okay, great. So I start on the outline with reaching out and recruitment. So I divided it into 2 parts. This is how kind of we do recruitment. And before I prepared this session, I called a number of women in the field from a variety of different organizations to try to get ideas both from them as well as my experience to try to put a package of ideas that are out there that perhaps we can all learn from and take home to our campuses. So the 2 broad areas of recruitment that I saw going on was student referrals and involvement and tabling. So first, let's look at student referrals. I will be honest and say this is how we recruit almost primarily. And I'd like to share some of the pros and some of the cons. So one of the pros and main pros, and this is why we do it, is because when we know the quality of our student, we're going to know more or less the quality of their friend. So if I have a student that is loves the program and is mature, doesn't mean for sure, but most likely she's going to be referring people that are going to be similar to her. Another pro is that it's not a cold call, meaning the student has heard about the program through their friends. They're not like, who are these crazy people? They've heard about it. They've heard positive things. So it's not, they're not coming in blind. They know what to expect. And when we ask students to recruit for us, we really, really encourage them to please call your friend ahead of time and say, by the way, Bela or whoever else is on the staff will be giving you a call about whatever program. That way it's not a cold call. Cold calls are much more challenging. So there's an introduction. One other thing that we do that we found very helpful is we do a raffle. At the end of our Maimonides program, we ask every student to give referrals. And every referral they give is like a little ticket in the raffle. And it has to be a referral that follows through. It has to be a referral that we get a meeting with. They can't just put down 50 names and none of them actually respond to our phone calls. It has to be a follow-through referral, which doesn't mean that they do Maimonides or the program, but it means we get a meeting with them. If we get a meeting with them, they get a little card, and we raffle off an iPod, something really nice. We found that to be extremely, extremely successful. And it really motivates students to bring in their best friends. And I found that when students who have had a really positive experience with the program and can't come up with their friends, they feel so bad. They apologize to us, which I think is a good thing, that they feel, it's not that they feel pressure to recruit, but that they apologize if they don't have enough friends. So I just like, please chime in as I go along with any comments or thoughts. So it's just not me speaking. I don't really like that. So, okay. The cons are you have to make sure that the student describes the program properly. We've had students who do a great job and bring in their friends, but don't do a good job of explaining what the program is actually about. So we do usually at some point in Maimonides in particular, a 5 to 10 minute information session. This is the type of information that you want to give your friend, and we give them a handout to pass to their friend. That way, we're doing our best to make sure that they are actually passing on the right information. The other thing, other downside, and I've had this experience, is I have a student that's amazing and I have a close relationship with her and she refers a friend. And because I think, my gosh, this friend's going to be amazing, I don't screen as properly as I should. So that's something I keep in the back of my mind, as if this is a student I'm really close with, I would be so excited to get a friend, to keep in the back of my mind, okay, be able to like slow down, make sure that she's actually a good fit for your program. The other main area of recruiting on campus is tabling, and I think that this is more challenging way of recruitment. I'll be honest, when we table for the entire campus, it's one of the few days I call out sick. So I can talk about the different ways to table, and then perhaps some of the blockages that prevent me or other women or other rabbis from feeling uncomfortable tabling in ways that I've been able to psych myself to actually do it. Number one, you have to know the dynamics of your campus. For example, at the University of Maryland where I work, no one tables except for 2 times a year.
I'm sorry. For those of us who, what is...
Basically, that means perfect. Thank you. Basically, tabling is a broad term for either setting up a little table or just handing out leaflets.
Oh, okay.
So standing on a corner of campus and just trying to pull people in. So at the University of Maryland, no one does that. The only person that does that is an Asian evangelical that walks up and asks, do you believe in Yeshua? I don't want to be him, so we don't do that. At NYU, Rabbi E, who came from Michigan, NYU doesn't have the same type of, it's in the city, it doesn't have the same type of community that University of Maryland has. everyone hands out leaflets in the middle. It's in the middle of New York City. He finds that very successful. So you have to know the dynamics of your campus and what is and what is not appropriate. So therefore, what we do, twice a semester, they have what's called First Look Fair, where all the student groups, it's on the mall of our campus, hundreds and hundreds of student groups from everything from Gymkhana, which is like trapeze artists, to the belly dancing club, to Jewish groups, all had their tables set up. We do that twice a year, and then we have a Hillel fair, like a Hillel barbecue. So obviously, when it's a Jewish event, it's much easier to table, or for me, it's much easier to table, because for me, the main awkward part is putting on your, my husband and Rabbi Ari Kretzky, who we work with, calls it the Judar, to try to figure out who's Jewish. That I have a little bit of trouble with. So I'll give you some different models of the way that people tend to pull in, try to pull in people through tabling. One is the direct model. This is the one my husband tends to use, and it's, do you happen at our campus, University of Maryland, our little mascot is a terrapin. For those of you that don't know, it's a large turtle. The title or the slogan of our school is Fear the Turtle. I don't know why they picked the turtle. It's like, whatever. Yes, yeah, so scary. And if you rub its head or like little whatever the turtles have, shell, yes, thank you, then you get good luck before an exam. So before exams, everyone rubs his little head. So anyways, Fear the Turtle. That is why we are jterps.com. If anyone sees on my email, it's because, yes, jterps, Jewish terps. I wish they picked a better animal. But anyways, so my husband just does it very directly. Do you happen to be a Jewish terp? Do you happen to be interested in Jewish programming? That's the direct model. The funny model, which I've seen Rabbi E use, is do you happen to be a matzah ball? Or some other version of that where you're kind of, it's a joke of like, or do you happen to be a bagel? Whatever it is, like you're joking around to try to people, to pull in people that way. And you have to,
that fits your personality.
Right, you have,
you can't do that. Rabbi's the only business card. He's the only
person. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I know two other people that do that and that successfully, and that's it. Rabbi E is very unique. That's why I said you have to figure out, that's why giving these examples, you have to figure out what model fits you best. This model does not fit me. One thing that we've done, I just put it under the creative model, that we've done very successfully at these kind of these first look fairs where there's all Jewish students and non-Jewish students, is we have a water bottle with our logo on it, and we say, would you happen to like some kosher water? Now, the Jewish students will say, I didn't know water had to be kosher. And the non-Jewish students will say, wow, thanks. So that we were able to immediately be like, okay, you're Jewish and you're not. It's just an easy way to kind of, whatever, separate it. I'll tell kind of a funny story. I have a little Maltese dog. Aliza and I think are, Aliza Bielena and I were only few people that actually have dogs. So I thought one year would be an awesome idea to bring my little Maltese puppy to First Look Fair. The only people he attracted were, and this is just the truth, were African-American young women who were taking my business card and calling me up for months afterwards asking to come for Shabbos. That's all he attracted. He didn't attract the Jewish students. It was all these wonderful African-American women who are really nice, but he's not coming anymore. That was the end of bringing him. But he does do Jewish tricks, treif and kosher and shalom and the hora and all these things, which our students love. Okay, so that's kind of the tabling model. The other thing I would talk about is how to get over your discomfort. And I'd love to hear, this is where, who has anyone tabled in this room and felt completely comfortable doing it? I've done it at like Hillel, where I know everyone's Jewish. I have not yet found a way for me to comfortably do it on the corner of wherever. So has anyone successfully, I think it's might be more of a rabbi thing.
Yeah, my husband
does it. Yeah, okay, yeah.
Like, what? Drink a big coffee and get a good night's sleep and just psych yourself up so you're in the best mood possible. Like,
also, you have to be.
It's a, it's a,
you have to, like, not feel bad that people, like, look at you like you're crazy and walk away from you. Like, that's part of it. And, like, don't...
Thick skin.
Right. Mm-hmm. You have to be thick skin. Like, you can't, you know... Like, a lot of people are going to just think you're nuts and walk away.
100%. That is true. I tell myself that everyone is doing this, meaning... Every campus organization is looking for this student to fit them. So they're all, I just what I think, we're all embarrassing ourselves today. Like, every single person that works for a student group, we are all embarrassing ourselves today. So I'm not the only one, but I think you're right that you have to get over the embarrassment and really psych yourself up and feel good about yourself. But I will be honest, this is something I am still working on. The final thing under tabling is how to get follow through on a good lead, because we found that students will give us fake numbers or things like that. So there's two suggestions that I have, that either you get their name and you Facebook them immediately. Personally, I hate Facebook for personal use. That's me. I'm sorry. Let me turn that off. I hate Facebook for personal use. I find it to be, whatever. I don't like it. But for professional use with college students, if I didn't use Facebook, they don't even use email anymore. If they don't, they just use Facebook. So if you Facebook them immediately, they might allow you to be friends with them. They might ignore you. But that's one way in, but you have to make sure that you do it that night. If you wait, they're not going to remember who you are. The other thing that we do, and we found this to be very successful, is if you give us your information on a card, and we have a card that fills out name, phone number, email address, the programs that you're interested in, we have a few different programs, you can check the box, then we will use that as a raffle. And we will raffle off, again, an iPod, a camera, whatever it is, and we have a Wii, whatever these things are, we have the box there. So everyone sees it. And they're going to give us the right information, because if we pull it out, they want the iPod or the iPad or whatever it is. So we found that to be very successful.
Who do you get to donate that?
Us. We pay for, I mean...
It's part of your budget.
No, whatever. It's every tier of organization. There's... I don't know. That's how we run. Like, there's not really a budget for everything. If we need it, we just do it because it's necessary, and we, whatever, figure it out. but we would include that as part of our, like, recruitment, under, like, the accounting, under the recruitment area. Okay, any other thoughts in terms of, like, recruitment or making sure you follow through, bringing in people through the door? I know, for example, the Livingstons and Northwestern use Shabbos meals. That's the only way they recruit. They have about 50, 60 people per Shabbos meal. That is their only way of recruiting. So there's a lot of ideas out there. I just put down those that I heard from other people and that I've used successfully. No, they have a house. This is what we have as well. We have a house on campus, and we have a house, our house. and we have, they have a few couples that go back and forth. Exactly.
It's mainly Shabbos meals that useful for getting information on them either.
So they basically, Rabbi Livingston remembers everybody's names and Facebooks after. I couldn't do that. I don't remember everyone's
name.
Rabbi
also has the most incredible name memory of anyone I've ever met in my life.
As does the other Rabbi Ari Karatsky. He knows everyone's, like, ex-boyfriends, roommates, ex-whatever. So if you're that type of person, you can do that. If you're not, then that might not be the way that you want to go.
I was just saying, if you know that there's a predominantly Jewish fraternity, Jewish sorority, like doing an event via like challah baking or whatever, if there is that on your particular campus, that works for some people.
So we've had, which I'm interested to hear from you, we've had very mixed results with fraternities and sororities. Actually, fraternities and sororities at Maryland are 50% Jewish. It's a very, very, very high ratio. We used to, when we started, involve sororities and fraternities a lot. We don't do that anymore. We found, and it very much depends on the campus, we found that as individuals, they're great people. As a pack, not so much.
Well, my husband was telling also not like into fraternities or sororities. Like, you need to be an independent thinker, and a lot of the people that he likes to learn with are, he doesn't go for the fraternity or sorority. However, he was talking to a student of his who was in Mahon Yako this year. Mm-hmm. He said he was the only guy who didn't come from a fraternity. So he's like, started to think, maybe it's not so bad. So, yeah.
I'm sure it depends on the campus.
I think along those lines also, that like they're not necessarily free thinkers, independent thinkers. They go with them. But then I started thinking, I guess it also a lot depends on the campus that you're coming from.
Right.
Like, it could be Michigan. They're not such free thinkers.
And also, if they're not free thinkers, then if you get the, like, the most charismatic guy in the fraternity to be on board with the program, you've got the whole fraternity house.
Right.
If they go with the pack.
Right. No, they do.
You know?
They definitely do.
You get them to come, but are they really?
But are they right? Where are they going?
That's what we found. That they come and they're super psyched, and they're the ones that are like, I love Shabbos, I love Shabbos. And they don't follow through. But it very much depends. I mean, because Maryland, the fraternity sororities are so Jewish, they feel they get their Jewish stuff. At another campus where it's not so Jewish, that might be a better in. It really, I think, just totally depends on the campus. I know that girls who I've been close to that are in a sorority are like, oh, Bela, do challah baking. And every time I try to set it up, it doesn't work. So finally I asked them, like, you're asking me to do this, and then you won't give me a date or a time. And they're like, well, we decided it was just, like, nerdy to do it. So it just really depends on your campus, and it depends on which fraternity and sorority. It happens to be the founding member of AEPI in Maryland, is one of our students at Learning Yeshiva, and is now living in Silver Spring, learning in Kollel. So it's not that you don't get people, it's that you have to be careful in picking out the right ones. And our approach has, instead of become getting them in packs, has been accepting only specific ones that sometimes mean we're going to lose them because they're not going to come as a group, in which case I try to learn with them as a group. I just try to separate them as much as possible. As individuals, they're awesome. As a group, I've just found it very difficult personally on my campus. Okay, so the next thing is kind of bringing in the first meeting, and I find this to be a very critical stage. So the first thing that I'm very aware of is making a connection and being yourself and being real. That's one of the things I'm going to talk about the panel later, but one question that I get asked a lot in College Kirov is, do you have to read the magazines and watch the movies and the TV shows they're watching? Do you have to be cool? And my answer is no way. You have to be you. You have to be genuine. The people that are most successful, everyone looks different. Everyone sounds different. Everyone has different styles. The people that are successful are real and authentic. And they have fake conversations, fake relationships all day. Everyone's posturing. It's the space where they can actually be themselves, and it's refreshing to find someone that is also comfortable in their own skin. Now, if a girl, if like half of my girls mention a show, I will look online to know what they're talking about. I won't watch it, I won't see it, but I just will look online for a description so I know what they're talking about if so many of them are, you know, buzzing about it. And then I try to use it. What I find most successful is I use that as a teaching tool. So they're all talking about The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, which is like the perfect in for, oh my goodness, the values of relationship in our society are a mess and Torah offers something so different. So I try to use that buzz to channel it into something more positive for them. But
of course you don't talk politics.
I never. Unless I have that down. I once had a student. Now, I do, like, for example, I do talk about stories in the news. That's different than politics.
You have meaning, to know what's going on in the world.
Right. And you can use current events very appropriately for class material or one-on-one material. But do not talk about politics. We once had, when Sarah was talking about this yesterday, we were inside a Shabbaton, and someone said, how could you vote for Obama? He's a monkey in a suit.
Oh, my gosh.
That's, they had an amazing Shabbaton, and that's all they talked about. We don't use that family anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Avoid politics in every way possible. That's actually my last thing, yeah. Okay, the other thing that I want to do in a first meeting is get the student talking about what they are interested in. One sign that I have for myself is that if I'm doing most of the talking, this is not going well. You have to get the student to talk about what they're interested in and then try to show how what they're interested in, you can make that connection to some program that you're doing. Now, you have to be honest. If someone's talking about saving the whales, I don't have a program that saves the whales. But I can talk about how Judaism believes that you have to, be careful with every resource that you're given, things like that. So you have to be genuine and honest, but you have to get the student talking about what they're interested in and then make a connection to some program that you're doing. The final thing that I think is very is actually critical in the first meeting is to determine whether or not the student is Jewish. So I'll share the tools that I use, and I'd love to hear any other suggestions. It's very sticky, and definitely people, when we first started, a lot more people have slipped through the cracks. Now we've gotten, after 8 years, we've gotten pretty good at it. We do occasionally, and this is with the policy of our organization, very, very occasionally take a student who's, let's say, father's Jewish and mother's not, or the mother did a so-so conversion, because they come with a group of friends. And if the friends have high potential and they're not going to do it unless their non-Jewish friend is accepted, we're given dispensation to accept them. We're not given any money, but we can take them into the program. And the goal is that by the end, they kind of realize that they're not fully Jewish. It's not a pleasant experience, which is why we try to limit it for many reasons. So this tends to be how we determine whether or not they're Jewish. So we ask them about their Jewish upbringing. That's a very normal and natural question to ask when you're trying to determine what Jewish program on campus is a good fit. And then I'll say, oh, how did your parents grow up? Did your parents grow up similar to you? What synagogue did they go to? You know, what town are they from? And I found that by asking about their parents' upbringing, the synagogue that they went to, did they have a positive experience in Hebrew school? Did they attend Hebrew school? Did they like their rabbi? Things like that. It very often comes out because they don't even realize it's a problem. They'll very openly say, oh, my mother wasn't raised Jewish, but she converted Reform. Or, oh, my father's not Jewish, which means they're Jewish, but that's a flag in my head for, that's an area of sensitivity. And usually they're very open with that. That's what we found to be the most normal and natural way. If they're not Jewish, what we do is we just don't pursue them. We're not at the meeting, we just kind of like, oh, okay, well, you know, we might have programs that we're interested, you're interested in, we'll see, and then we just don't follow up with them. So it's not obvious that we don't want them involved, but usually if you don't follow up with a student, they're not going to be super proactive. They tend to not be super proactive people in general. Yes. Yeah, sometimes the non-Jews are, but I found for the most part, if you like are kind of just very vague, they'll send you an email, you're very vague, they'll usually drop it. That's what I found, but it could be different at other campuses. Does anyone else have thoughts?
I have a question.
Yeah.
What if you find out later? Like, do you usually say something or you don't?
It depends on the situation. We've had a number of girls, and actually Lynn and Madrasa Rahal have helped us with a few of these girls who have issues of gay risk chumra. That we've had, gay risk chumra, meaning their mother's mother converted, but the conversion was questionable. Was she, like, she didn't keep the mitzvah, she wasn't from afterwards, or the rabbi who did the conversion turned out to not be Shomer Shabbos, kosher, or anything else when he was doing the conversion. There's all sorts of situations. Right, it's very common.
I wanted you to define it.
It's very common. The more challenging situation is them not being Jewish at all. So what we try to do is in a class setting, in a kind of talk about, and it comes up, you know, according to traditional Judaism, who's Jewish and who's not. For some students, it will click, for some not. And we ask, it's a very individual thing, and we ask our Rabbi Gershenfeld, our rabbinic mentor, about every situation. They're some of the hardest conversations that I've ever had to have. We had a student who, I was working with the girl, my husband was working with the brother, he was engaged to someone that was a conservadox, wanted to marry someone Jewish, and their mother had said is that she converted in Iran. And at that point, in Iran, the only conversions that were being done were completely from conversions, reform and conservative doesn't exist. 2 weeks before the wedding, she informs her son that she never completed the conversion. She never went to the mikvah. She never did anything. She was just interested.
What made her tell him?
I think out of guilt. She was about to get married. I mean, I don't know her. I know the sister. She was on our Israel trip. And he told his fiance, they ended up not getting married, and I had to tell the sister. The sister came to me and was like, Bela, this can't be true. Of course I'm Jewish. It's the hardest, some of the hardest conversations I've ever had to have. But I think it's something that you have to be very sensitive about. It's very much on a case-by-case basis, and you have, personally, I feel I have to ask someone way bigger than me and way more experienced than me in this area because it's so, so, so sensitive. Okay, so the next area after the first meeting is the learning opportunities. And this, I think, I really want to hear all your ideas for the learning, learning ideas and suggestions that you have on your campus. So I put down Maimonides 1, 2, and 3. I imagine most people sitting around the table are familiar with the Maimonides program. Yeah, so I don't have to like go into it in detail. A lot of campuses do Maimonides 2, especially because now we can get a student who does Maimonides 2, we can get a $1,500 stipend for a 3-week trip, which is a really nice incentive to run a Maimonides 2 and to get a student to do it. We have added Maimonides 3 just kind of as the longer we go, the more our students want, and what we try to do is make it more text-based, more challenging as they go along through the program. Unless someone wants to talk about it, I won't spend that much time on that, because I imagine most of you are pretty familiar with Maimonides. What I do mostly is one-on-one learning. As I said, I learn with about 35 to 40 girls a week. I've been asked a number of times, do I pay them? How do I get them in? I don't pay them. They don't get anything. They learn with me, and I can share kind of how I've been able to build that up, and it's taken a number of years to build that up. So number one is kind of the pitch. So there has to be a prior connection. That's what I found, either in the first meeting. I learn with some students one-on-one who haven't done Maimonides, but we've had a great first meeting, or students that have done Maimonides, I make sure that the girls that I feel have highest potential, we have two tracks in Maimonides, so we have about 60 to 70 students in Maimonides. I can't talk to every girl. So I make sure that the girls that I think are going to have the highest potential, I make sure to have a meaningful conversation with them so I can pull them into the one-on-one learning. One thing that I have noticed a significant difference in is when I first started, I would call up a girl and be like, hi, this is Bela. I don't know if you really have time, and I don't know if you're really interested, but if you are, I do this learning thing on campus. It's just a short amount of time. Would you be interested? If you're nervous, they're going to sense that, and they're going to say no. Now what I do, and like night and day, shift. If you're confident in what you're doing, and I find this in general in Kirov, if you're not, like, if you're confident in the Torah that you're teaching, you're going to feel comfortable and confident, and the student's going to sense that. If you're nervous or uncomfortable, unsure about it, they're going to sense that as well. So now what I do is I call them up and say, well, we had such a wonderful conversation. I try to reference the conversation. I would love to learn with you this semester. I'm so excited. What day and time works best for you? I'm not giving them, that's much harder to wriggle out. And if they say, I'm not sure if I have time, I say, oh, it's just, you tell me, it's about 35 minutes. You find 35 minutes in your schedule, we're going to make it work. I'll work around you. I've had very few students that get out that way. Now I'm targeting the girls that are going to gain from it. I don't target the girls that aren't. I have one girl a semester who pulls out, and that's it, out of 35 to 40. And they don't usually feel pressured because this is the way everyone works. Everyone recruits this way. Every organization on campus recruits this way because they want to get you in the door. Yeah?
How do you make that judgment?
That's a very good question, and that is what I've seen for myself personally is that the longer that you're involved, the easier it is for you to make that determination. So the things that I look for are, and this is based on experience as well as guidance from Rabbi Gershenfeld, is number one, good mitos. We found that students that have good mitos are going to be much more likely to follow through. Students that have bad mitos or are selfish are less likely to follow through. We used to get really excited about the students who are like, I love Shabbos, I love Shabbos, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love kosher, I love this, I love that. We used to be so excited by them, now we're not. Those are the students. Sorry?
I hate to say it, but the ones like, that what's are wrong with you?
Right, meaning...
What's lacking in your life that you're suddenly so excited about something?
Exactly. And usually these are the type of people that are excited...
It's the same with NCAA, like the teenagers.
Or attention, or are very excited by everything, but have no follow-through. So they're whatever they're in... being spoken to about, they're like super excited, and then they move on to the next thing. So what I look for is students that, whether it's one-on-one learning or in Maimonides, are consistent and make commitments. And one thing that I look for, I found one of the hardest blockages to be being able to give up control of your own like self belief that I know everything is right. So those students in conversations that constantly say, well, it's just because I feel this way. I don't like Shabbos because I don't feel it. It's just not me. Or students that are not open to having a real dialogue and are not open to at some point admitting, oh, that I might be willing to change my mind about that. Those are the signs that I look for. So it's like good mitos, follow through and commitment and willingness to be like humble.
Okay, two practical questions. We're one-on-one learning 30-35 people a week, so you've been doing this for a little while, so I assume you have a lot of things to learn about, but A, how do you decide what to learn with each person, and B, are you doing 35 different things, or are you repeating a lot of it, like, this semester, then I'm learning with half the people I'm doing this, and half the people I'm doing that?
Great question. So the next thing on my outline was going to be topics. So I'll try to address both questions. So I have usually, by the time, like, because I've been on campus for a while, so I try every semester to develop one good, really good new program. So that means that every semester I have an additional one. I don't have time. I just don't have the time to prepare five new things. So, but after being on campus for a certain number of semesters, I've built up a repertoire. So one thing that I feel very strongly in one-on-one learning. Some people feel very strongly about group learning, which I'm going to talk about next. personally, I prefer one-on-one learning. I'm able to develop a one-on-one relationship. I'm also able to encourage them lovingly one-on-one. It's much harder to do that in a group. I just can't give loving masseur in a group. So very often, it's open question and answer in the beginning. It's we call it whatever, Jewish pinball. Ask me anything. And we just have a back and forth. That's a great way in the beginning to develop a rapport and a trust.
So that means you're dealing with people who already have some sort of knowledge that they're missing knowledge?
Nope. Sometimes I'm dealing with students that have done Maimonides. Very often I'm dealing with students that we only deal with students that have no background. So they might have had a Hebrew school experience, but it was bad. But there are very typical questions that come up, very often starting with women in Judaism. Depending on the student, I sometimes do that more in a conversational type way, or depending on other students, I have a text-based source. But I find open question and answer. They just want to know, what does Judaism believe about this? And what does Judaism believe about that? Because they don't know anything, they want to know everything. So the open question and answer, by starting by the open question and answer, they see that I'm normal, that I'm relatable, that I think it was Rabbi Gottlieb that was talking about this, that that you know, I am interested in things they're interested in, so I'm building rapport in order to move on to more challenging topics.
You sit down with them and you say, you know, this is an open, you're welcome to ask whatever you want about Judaism.
The way that I open is usually by just building personal rapport. So
right,
I've done that in the first meeting.
So then I have a question. I think that you said you were a trained therapist
Yes.
as well. So am I. And I find that I get, you know, people get stuff, people sense that about me even if I don't tell them. And like end up just kind of like spilling. And which is fine to a point, but like Lemaisa, I'm not their therapist, I'm their, you know what I mean? So then like where is the natural transition point and boundaries and kind of like that to transition into learning, because you know there is a choice, like they're both valuable, but at some point you have to, you know, you do have to choose about
that. That's a great question. I'm very open and honest with them that my background is in marriage and family therapy, because it means they're going to be much more open about their relationship. It's not just me as an observant woman who believes these things. I bring back up as a marriage therapist. So I usually, and it depends on the students, and it's a fine line, and everyone works differently. There's a very successful Rebbetzin that she doesn't talk about personal life at all. That's not me. That's just not me. I'm like a relationship person. So I am open to going into personal things, and I'm very, very careful to refer to therapists and to be very clear. I'm not your therapist, but that is something that I struggle with. Who am I? I'm not your friend. I'm not your friend. I'm your mentor. Am I your Jewish mom? It's hard. It's hard to find a title. I think we are all half. My favorite title is like Jewish mom, personally, but I think that it's different for every student, but I do start out with very often personal things because it builds rapport, and I feel very strongly that college is one of the hardest ages for women, or hardest time in a woman's life, and they have no one to talk to. They feel pressure to do a variety of things. I'll get into this a little bit more later, but they feel pressure to do a variety of things that they really don't want to do, but they think it's so uncool. So these give me windows. So what I try very hard to do is to take the personal thing and connect it to Torah. One thing that I found, and I was very quick to change, is students will even say, wow, Bela gave me great advice. I'm very now quick to, it's not Bela advice, it's Torah advice. I don't want them to, I mean, I want them to feel that I'm the channel for that, but I don't want them walk, Bela's so smart, and I'm like, but no, I'm not smart, Torah's smart, Hashem's smart, you know, like, this is all coming from this. I'm very quick to connect whatever suggestions I'm giving to Torah, and I haven't found that many students that get stuck in that. I found that if I'm able to show that Torah has a relevant message to your personal problem, that it can be a natural leeway. Now, there are some students that that's not the case, and I tell them, I have at least two girls a semester that are like this, and I tell them, I say, you know, I think that we seem to be going over the same thing again and again, and I want to be able to offer you something new and fresh. Perhaps that would be better discussed, I mean, I've already probably said this, with a therapist, but at this point I think it would be most beneficial to move on to something else. And at that point, they trust me, and I've not had a lot of fight about that. They're usually like, okay, if you think that's going to help, that's fine.
And what, I don't know, this is kind of on the same vein and kind of tangential, and everyone, I'm sure, you know, some of you might have also had experience. What about people, students or whatever, people who you're working with who get stuck, not necessarily in an emotional issue, but in a philosophical issue, that you just keep continuously revisiting and revisiting and revisiting, and then, like, at con, like...
Can I just, because I was given some really good advice when I got my first job at the ADL, the Antidote Information League, which is a Jewish organization, not from. And there was a from guy there, and he's basically responsible for recovering me. And so when I found out he was Orthodox, I like laid every women's issue at his doorstep. I was like, you know, every lunch break. And he said to me, you know, if you can temporarily, this only works on some people, worked on me. He said, you have to temporarily take your issues and put them on a shelf and go learn about Torah. And then every once in a while, take them down and wrestle with them again, put them back on the shelf and go learn some more. Because he explained to me that if I'm like looking through the glasses of how I grew up, feminist, reconstructionist, secular, whatever, whatever, I'm like, it's like when you're at the fun house and you're looking in the mirror and everything like looks distorted, like you're not gonna see Torah for what it is, you're gonna see it through your preconceived notions. So look, I was in a position to be makabel that, and I was like, okay, I'm going to approach this like an anthropologist, you know, like just objective and like see what the Torah has to say without my stuff getting in the way. And that's how he was able to get me to move on without constantly getting stuck on that. You know, and every few months, something would happen. You heard some things last night, and I'd be like, wah, you know, back in my thing. And then I would talk myself through it and be like, okay, but I'm just going to go and like learn some more. So I don't know, that works for me.
One thing that I tell students, that I'm very direct, and I tell them, okay, and this is something I'll talk about later, I am not by nature I'm a direct person, but I'm not a assertive person. I have become assertive, and I'll share with you a little later why, based on actually student advice. But I'm very honest with students, and when we start meeting, I say what I want out of this relationship is honesty. I want you to be completely honest with me, and I'm going to be completely honest with you. Is that something that you're comfortable with? And once they say yes, I have been able to have such breakthrough conversations. And what I say to them is, wow, it seems to be I'm answering the same questions. Again and again, and you seem to kind of get it up here, but it's not connecting down here. Maybe we can talk about what experiences have you had that have prevented it from penetrating here, because if you're asking something again and again, then there's usually some sort of emotional blockage, and I call it out, and they usually will admit it. Or Devorah's advice is definitely meaningful. And what I say, women in Judaism, I grew up, my parents are Balei Tshuva, I'm the oldest, so I kind of became from, my mother didn't cover her hair until I was probably 7 or 8. My first till third grade, I went to public schools. We lived in South Dakota. I don't know how my parents did it. My parents were newly Shomer Shabbos, and they kept Shabbos kosher every day. Taras Bishbach in South Dakota. They were the only from family in 3 states.
Wow.
I have no idea how I did it, especially now in Kirov. I call my parents up. I'm like, they're on the phone, so they can't see that. But I try to communicate as best as I can in words. So I struggled with women in Judaism as well. So usually I say to them that I share my own experience, and I say, when I was growing up, I said, I hate the woman in the front of the room. I will never be her who says that women in Judaism are amazing. Ever. I will never, ever be her. And look, that is what I find to be, and this is honestly and completely true, I find to be myself, not as a Jewish person, but as a Jewish woman, to be what I find the most amazing part of my life. So sometimes the blockages are signs that this is something that can set you free. That this issue is something that can open you up to things that you never, ever find otherwise. And I just share my own personal experiences. I would have been so sad. It would have really made my life so much less meaningful if I had just been stuck on this and not been open to really hearing things. And so all, and kind of similar to what Devorah kind of said, is clearly something that you're struggling with, but if you make it the center of everything, you're not going to be able to move past it, and it would be so sad. And what I found very consistently is that the girl who's struggling the most with tznius ends up, when she's from, that tznius is the most meaningful part of who she is. I've just found that both in therapy and in life, the thing that you struggle with the most can be the thing that kind of sets you free and gives you the most meaning and empowerment in your life.
I think it's also important, I mean, first of all, it's so humbling to be here with so many experts, but I think it's also important that when you're speaking with someone, that you acknowledge the fact that just because you have an issue now and it's resolved doesn't mean that you're never going to have any more intellectual, you know, conflicts in your mind. And sometimes when people hear that, they think like, wow, I'm actually looking for an answer because I'm going to keep having questions throughout the rest of my life, and they want to move on, and they want to find an answer, whereas they're not getting hung up in keeping on asking a question.
I think that's a very good point. One thing that I tell students all the time is that
just because you get past it doesn't mean you're going to you've hit like the peak of growing. Like, you're going to keep going afterwards, so you may as well just embrace an answer and find something that you're happy with.
No, I think that's a very good point. And one thing that I share, and I share a lot personally, that's something I feel comfortable with, but I share with them that there were questions that I used to have that are now I'm comfortable with, and questions or answers that are issues that I used to be fine with that I now have questions about. But that's part of life growth. Judaism doesn't believe perfection in our 20s, 30s, 20s, or 50s. How depressing is that? The point of life, and I think what you're getting at, the point of life is to continue to grow. So embrace the questions, embrace the struggle. Don't kind of look at it as a negative thing. Judaism believes that questions are amazing and beautiful. And I'll share personal examples in my own life. And I find that, again, going back to Ray Gottlieb, they're like, oh, wow, you have questions too. And they feel a lot more comfortable.
Like, even though you know so much more, you still have questions. So.
Definitely. Definitely.
And you know what? Sometimes I find like certain things that, you know, I'm honest also, and I'll say, like, you know what, I struggle with that question also. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I know there are people bigger than me. That's another thing we always have to realize, is that we don't have to have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Anyone working here always feels like, I have to have all the answers right now. Right. You know, sometimes say, like, well, you know what, I struggle with that same question. And I've spoken to this rabbi and that rabbi, and, you know, I feel like maybe as my life goes on, I'm going to be able to, that's going to sit better with me.
I find them.
And sometimes we can move on together.
Are the ones who admit their struggles. Like Esther Bela Schwartz, who's Rabbi E's big sister. She's like my Rebbetzin, and she's so real. She's so hushed, but she's so real about, like, I struggled with this, you know? Right. I struggled with being home with my kids when I wanted to be in Shul Yom Tov. I'm like, really? I'm not the only one?
Sometimes
it makes me feel great.
They just look at me like, yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, really? And then we just,
that's
like,
why she's effective.
And we just, like, hold hands and move on. It's like, but you know what? I can still live this life, and I'm okay with it, you know?
100%. One thing that when I teach, one of the things, and this is what I was actually going to get into next in topics, tefillah is something I talk about. The first thing that I say when I talk about tefillah is that this is something that I struggle with. That's an ongoing issue for me. And as you said, I think that, and I tell them, I hope that, you know, we can learn together. And it takes a lot of the edge off. And if I'm not honest, they're going to sense that I have challenges with tefillah, and they're going to not trust me.
But sometimes also you can say, like, you know, this is an amazing question. Do you know that the biggest sages in Judaism have struggled with this question?
and that there are volumes and volumes written about this question. I mean,
it's
some
so
of the
funny
huge
how
questions.
I think that they're the first ones to ask this question. I'm like, okay, you got to look at Gemara.
Like, you know, like the rabbis have struggled with this question for thousands of years. You know, it's like, oh, you know, and Judaism has moved on anyway. You know what I mean? So, like, also, sometimes you can release people, you know, like just acknowledging that we don't always, we can always be searching for questions, for answers, and that's part of our experience.
I also use that as like an empowering, like, wow, do you realize that what you latched onto, the greatest minds in Judaism also thought of, which is like a little, you know, like just basically off of yours. Right, exactly. And they're like, and then they not only feel wow, they have questions, but wow, like I have the same one.
Yes, I know, but and a lot of times it's true. Your kids in the campus are asking the same thing that the Rambam has written, you know, whatever. It's just,
and when they realize the enormity of the question, they realize that this is not a snap answer. Let's work with other things and keep this in the
And so just briefly, I can give you some, and I'm interested to hear the topics that you find most meaningful. I'll just give you some examples. I do women in Judaism. I do tefillah. So funny, I don't do Pirkei Avos because I feel it's like everyone else does it. So I don't know, but Pirkei Avos happens to be a great tool that a lot of people use. I try very hard to, for a lot of girls, do text-based classes because one point that I feel is so critical is that in Judaism, unlike other religions, we never believe that the Torah was supposed to be kept in the hands of the elite, or that's why why Jews were always so literate. One person whose material I found to be so, I don't use anyone else's, is Rabbi Foreman, who's Mrs. Felsen's brother, right. He has material online. You can download it for free. He has books. His approach, the challenge that I have to text-based with students that don't know any Hebrew and have never really studied a text before is, how do I do this when they don't know, as I said, don't know any Hebrew? Right, Foreman's material, it's all in English. Your student doesn't have to have any background. Your student doesn't have to know any Hebrew. Your student has never had to have looked at a chumash before, and they're able to feel, and I tell them, like, I don't want to spoon feed you this information. This is your Torah as much as it is my Torah. I want you to be empowered to engage in your Torah. And I found that they love it. They love it.
You say that because I find sometimes I have the opposite, where you have some women that say, we want a text. We want to learn from a text. Give us the Hebrew to read. Like, they're very, like, they like to feel a part of it. And then it's hard to find something that's, like, you know, hard enough for some of the people, or, like, that's meaningful enough, or that's not, like, you don't want to read the Talmud. You want to read the Parsha. You don't want to, like, you want to get somewhere in 45 minutes.
But this is text-based, and I will bring the chumash. I bring the chumash, and that way it's sitting there. Very often we'll read the first pasuk, and then they don't need to read any more in the Hebrew. But Rabbi Foreman, he takes the pasuk, it's in English, but then so much of his material is about the Hebrew words and how we're misunderstanding the Hebrew words by using the English. So that gives them a hole into learning the Hebrew, and they feel like, wow, okay, I'm learning the Hebrew, I'm engaging in the Hebrew text without having to go word by word by word by word. His material is awesome. He has a book or two out, but if you just do a search for Rabbi Foreman, you can download. He has source material you can print out, and it's for free. If you want, you can make a donation. You don't have to. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal material for those students that want something text-based. That's all personally. So one that I use a lot, I will say, I prefer. He doesn't have books on everything. I think that's something he's working on. The classes can sometimes be a little long because he's giving it in a class, and it was a week. He gave this class a week before, so the good first 15-20 minutes can be a repetition of what I just heard, and they heard the week before, but I just heard it 30 seconds ago. So that's one of the challenges.
The audio.
The audio. To the audio.
There's a lot of interaction, so you're hearing what a lot of people in the audience are in the class are saying. It's like, come on, just get
exactly,
this.
Exactly, so exactly. So those topics that he has books on, I recommend over the...
The tapes, right? The Gracious Book and the McGillicuddy
right.
that just came out.
Right. So the McGill, right. So I, it's called Serpent of Desire. It's a book. I actually first prepared it before the book came out online or on the tapes. I don't even remember, but it's about.
Beast that crouches at the door.
That's the title. So that's the title of his book, Beast that. Crouch at the door. Desire. The title of his talk online is Serpents of Desire.
What is that? What's the title?
So basically, and I use this, it's one of my favorite classes ever, and I'm happy to email you my prepared material so you guys don't have to like go through all the classes yourself. But it talks about eating from the Eitz Hadas Torah, but it talks a lot about how desire and want and passion skews our reason. It's so relevant for college campus. So relevant. And it helps me introduce topics. That's why I love this class. I learn it with everyone I can because it introduces them to topics of the Yetzer Hara, and then I can refer back to it. When a student comes to me and is like, I've had this happen, plan to go to seminary, have the ticket, and 2 weeks before, call hysterically, I'd be like, I can't go to seminary. Like, why? What happened? And it sounds like someone passed away. She's like, my luggage broke! Meaning, like, the Yetzer Hara is so creative that it will find anything. So I then, because I learned this
like
with her... Yeah, but, like, not even that! Meaning that might be something real! The Yetzer Hara is so creative that it convinces them that this is a real issue when they can really just go out. I'll go and I'll buy with them another piece of luggage. It's not a big deal, but it doesn't matter. It's there because it's the Yetzer Hara. But because we've learned this, I can say, wow, what voice does that sound like? And they'll process it with me and they'll be like, is that the Yetzer Hara? Because we've learned it, I can refer it, and I use it all the time with them in relationships, with them whatever else. Sometimes I won't use the Yetzer Hara, but I will say, ooh, is that the Serpent of Desire? And I find that language to be very useful when they're in the middle of in a relationship that they know they shouldn't be in, logically, but they feel blah, 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 blah. That's one of the reasons I love this class, because not only is it text-based and accessible, but it's lessons that number one, is lessons that they see the depth of Torah and the depth of Hebrew. I think it's a great way to answer, is Torah written by God without answering it directly? And it also uses material that I can then refer back to. And then women in Judaism, and then I do sometimes Parsha, and I do a lot of Yemen Tovim when it's relevant. Any other topics that people have found? Relationships.
I mean, with teenagers, I use a lot of Gila Mandelson's books, the ones that are more advanced, that they love. I don't know.
Yeah, her material's great.
I like going through that book.
Yes. One book.
Do your first interview with, or your first class where you're saying, just like, what would you, what talk about? Do you use that as your guidance of what to teach this particular student? Or you just are going to teach what you're going to teach?
So, no, I ask them, and usually, because they feel that I don't want to say, I ask them, I give them examples, and then usually they say, I don't know, what do you suggest?
Right.
So I've gotten both. They feel like they've chosen it. And I can teach what I think
so you
is
sort of
most
do an offering of, you know,
I give them these are 4 to 5 topics that I usually learn with. You know, if you're interested in something else, I'm open to trying to, I can't commit that I can have a lot of time to prepare it, like, whatever. Very, very, I've only had this in 8 years. Very occasionally will a girl come in with this big esoteric topic that I would have to spend hours researching. And usually that's not the girl that's actually going to grow and learn from it. She just is... whatever, stuck on this topic for whatever reason. But that way I find that they feel like they're choosing when they're really are being guided.
Right.
Gently guided. Okay.
One of your like four or five options would be, or we could just start off with question and answer.
Mm-hmm. We can start off with question and answers. We can do women in Judaism. We can do prayer. We can do something more text-based. And then usually they say, what recommendation would you make? We talk a little more about what they want to get out of it. And then I make a recommendation, and they're fine with it. One thing.
Are these Kahula meetings?
Yes. Once a week, 40 minutes throughout the whole semester, unless, obviously, there's breaks, Yom Tovim, they're sick, finals. One thing that I do that I find critical is I text, even girls that I've been learning with for 4 years, I text everyone, and I usually learn 8 to 10 girls a day. I text them all the night before and say, hi, just confirming we're meeting tomorrow, can't wait to see you. That way, because sometimes they cancel, and I don't want to be stuck sitting on campus with three, like when I could have been meeting with someone else or consolidated. And that way I'm reminding them, and I'm allowing them, I'd rather that they reschedule, and usually it's rescheduling. Very rarely is it just canceling. It's usually, oh wow, I had a meeting with a professor this week, I need to reschedule, but that way I know beforehand. And college students are slightly responsible, so this just helps give them a friendly reminder. And I tell them, oh, you know, I know I'm so busy, I sometimes forget things, so it's just, you know, best, you know, easiest for me means it's for you, I'll just text you, and they just get used to it, and it becomes kind of a joke after 4 years, and I'm still texting, it becomes a joke, and it's like, but I still do it, because they occasionally still forget, even after 4 years. One thing that I think it's been very helpful for me in going into one-on-one meetings and is having my own goals. Because sometimes I was finding I was learning with girls, and like we're talking, but I'm not really getting anywhere. So what I try to do before I start learning with someone in the beginning of the semester is, what is my goal for this student for this semester? What do I want them to have gained by the end of the semester? And then I try in my own mind before every meeting. Now, I'll be honest, sometimes I don't have the time to do this before every meeting, but I do my best before every meeting to say, what do I want this student to walk away from this meeting? Because otherwise, sometimes we can be all over the place. So even if we go off on tangents, I always try to bring it back to a takeaway message that they can then take home. And if it's in my mind, it's likely going to be in theirs. Yeah.
Did you ask them one of their goals?
Yeah, that's one of the, meaning that's when I'm talking about what topic they want to choose, I always ask.
But the goals of spending time with you.
That I usually ask after a good few meetings. I usually don't ask that right off on the bat because they will say, I don't know. Unless it's a Maimonides student, in which case, so if a student has prior learning, I will ask that. If a student had prior learning, I don't usually ask that until the middle. And with every student, I usually make a long-term and short-term goal plan for each.
Can you give some examples of the type of long-term?
Yeah, that it just Yeah, we'll get there. It just helps me to kind of, yeah, go.
10 minutes.
Oh my, gosh, we have 10 minutes. Oh my goodness gracious. Okay, fine.
No so, patience.
Whoa. Okay, fine. So I'm gonna skip. Okay, group classes and learning. The pros is that you're creating a community. The cons is I found scheduling to be really hard. Okay, how does help students grow practically? So we have to actively encourage students to keep mitzvos. Change does not happen unless people are uncomfortable, and unfortunately, it is our job to make them uncomfortable. This is the hardest thing for me to do, but this is why I do it. I had a student named Gabby who for 2 years wanted to go to Neve. I want to go to Neve. She went to Neve and crashed, and she came back sobbing, and said, Bila, it's not your fault, but I wish you would have encouraged me to take steps before, because once I got there, it was too much. And I've heard this from so many students, and I tell the students this story. We once had a madricha who said, like, it's not me to encourage someone to do a mitzvah. like, I will be, this is something that took me many years to work on, but if at some point you're not going to be comfortable doing that, you should, like, Kirov perhaps might not be the best, or this area of Kirov might not be the best option. You have to actively, I won't change, change is uncomfortable, I'm not going to change unless someone makes me uncomfortable, so the same for me, but so how do I do it? So number one is the relationship is primary, and I will only say something if I feel the love at that moment. I check myself. Do I love this girl so much right now? And the way I frame it is I love you so much, and they know it. They know I would do anything for them. And because I love you so much, I so badly want you to be happy. And this is a way for you to be happy, but it has to be based in love. You have to be able to build trust in students, so you have to be consistent with them. So many students have bad prior experiences with trust issues or boyfriends or whatever, and if you aren't consistent with them, they're not going to trust you either. So you have to try. Every so often I cancel a bar, but I will try to reschedule with them. I answer their phone calls. I try to be as consistent as possible. Obviously, you have to also create space for yourself and your family, but I try to be consistent with them in order to build trust. One thing that I find is very, very meaningful is, this is how I frame it, is that I speak as your inner Jewish voice. I don't speak as my voice, I speak as your inner Jewish voice, and your inner Jewish voice is covered up by bad Hebrew school experiences, bad experiences with from people, I don't say it to them this way, schmutz, taiva, whatever else, it's just been covered up, so I'm giving voice to your inner Jewish voice. So I am extremely careful. When a student says to me, Bela, I love Shabbos, I'd love to keep Shabbos one day, I, right after the meeting, when they don't see, I write that down. And then when I have the opportunity, I repeat that back to them because it will sound familiar and it comes from them. It's not me. It sounds like, okay, oh wow, this feels like home, because that's what they really want inside. So I'm very careful to remember what they want and frame it as, my job is not to be my voice, it's to be your inner Jewish voice. I try to help every student make a concrete plan of short-term and long-term goals. This has three benefits. Number one, it helps students it helps me to guide students to pick two to three concrete things that they can do. If they're not going to be able to do 2 to 3 concrete small steps, it's going to be just like the story of the girl crying when she went to Neve. It's going to be very, very hard for her to actually take a big step like keeping Shabbos. Number two, it helps them feel not overwhelmed. One thing that I've seen very often, students feel so overwhelmed. There's so much I want to do and I'm so inadequate. So I tell them, work really hard on being consistent on these 2 to 3 things and chill out about the rest. Don't worry about it. We'll get there when we get there. I find that to be very freeing for them, so they don't feel bad about themselves all the time. Finally, it helps me assess where they're at. So sometimes I just take for granted that a student believes in God when they actually don't. So it helps me assess where they are by having the short-term and long-term plan, and therefore it allows me to gauge, without asking them directly, do you believe in God? It helps me gauge where they're actually at. Examples of steps, and this I put under mitzvah ideas somewhere, is starting out, if they want to do tefillah, starting out with Moda Ani or Shema. It's something when you wake up, something you go to sleep. I try to help them pick something that is daily and weekly. So the one step that's daily consistent and one step weekly. And to say Shema before you go to sleep is very, very doable. This is a good first start. Then like light candles and keep Shabbos for an hour. But I find it's very important to not just be like, oh, I'm going to keep Shabbos at point. Pick an hour. 1 hour that's the same hour. It can be Friday night if you want to move up. Bump it up. It can be you keep Friday night or you keep Shabbos from 12 to 4 on Shabbos afternoon. But it has to be a chunk of time. If it's just keep Shabbos at some point for an hour, they're not going to do it. They're going to forget about it. What I tell them, and I think this is critical, is what Judaism believes, Reform, conservative, orthodox, I don't like those labels. What we all have to be is growing Torah Jews. So my job and your job is the exact same, and that is to grow a little more today than I did yesterday. And that, so that's the way I frame it, and I think it frees up a lot of misconceptions, etc., etc., etc. So I say there's no mitzvah that's black and white. They're an ideal of how to get there, but you think tznius is like your tznius, so you're not, that's not the case. You can connect to tznius even if you're not going to dress like me. So I have a bunch of girls this summer who are not wearing tank tops. That's a big step.
How do you approach tznius?
Someone's already
Shomer Shabbos.
If someone's already Shomer Shabbos,
I'm like not...
Not tznius?
The tznius piece.
So I address it as try to get to the source of, like, the self-esteem. If someone is Shomer Shabbos and still not keeping tznius, they very often have body image issues or low self-esteem, and in that case, I will call it out if I have close enough relationship with them and refer them to a therapist to work on it. But what I usually say is, and this is like on one leg since we're out of time, I have a whole class and approach on tznius that I'd be more than happy to share. But I say about tznius and Shomer Negiah is these are the things that will set you free. And I say to them that marriage, the divorce rate is like 60%, and that's the couples that are actually getting divorced. Imagine how many couples are fighting and not happy. And these are tools. You know, if someone said to you, oh, you could get a college degree in 1 month, you would say, there's something wrong with that. This is meaningful. I have to work hard. You're going to have to work hard. And you know, if you want to have a good relationship, these are tools. I can talk more specifically about tznius.
You know, seeing the women who are coming from the campuses and everything, that tznius is the last issue to go.
Yes.
It's a very, very hard issue to work with. It has a lot to do with a person's whole self-image, not just self-esteem, but self-image, and what they view as who they are. How I look is who I am, and I don't really want to change that. So you have to be very careful when you're working with somebody on tznius that you're not giving a message that I want to change you to the core. That's not what you're doing. Tznius is very hard. I don't know, but I would say, like, imagine in your position on campus where you're working with students who are at a much more basic level, that I would even let it go. Until much later in the game, and let other people deal with it.
I'm only asking at much later stage.
I was 9 months at Neve, and still like taking my twin set off in the summer, and Rebbetzin Green Information Tov was like, "Honey, what's wrong?" I mean, it's really hard. I took sleeves on 4 summers.
I happen to deal with tznius. Not complete tznius. The concept of tznius. The concept of, have you all been in an environment where you're talking to a guy and he's not looking at your face? The goal of tznius is to help, is that people respect you for your ideas and thoughts. When you speak to the rabbis on campus, do you feel like they're listening to your ideas and thoughts? That's the goal of tznius. So I get to the concept behind tznius, which I find very empowering, but I do not get to the halacha. But for some girls that are more advanced, to not wear tank tops, I think is a great step for a more advanced student who's ready for that and who asks, I want to work on tznius, can you give me an example? But I will not pick that as the first thing. The one thing, and then the other thing that I really share with them is just to be consistent, that it's more difficult to be inconsistent. If you tell, you know, oh, I'm keeping Friday night Shabbos, but I'll go to my best friend's birthday party in a car, but I won't go to another friend's party, it's a lot more difficult because then people don't respect you as much, you're going to have a lot more argument than if you're just consistent. And if one time you break it, you can always be honest and say, I'm working on it, this is something I'm struggling with, but I'm working on it. But you have to be consistent, otherwise it's confusing to other people and it's confusing to you. I'm going to skip Shabbos. Alright, time up.
Just keep going.
You can keep going, but
I'll cut out.
What's next?
Lunch.
Oh, okay. So anyone who wants to, please go eat. And if anyone wants to say you're welcome, I will absolutely not be offended if you go eat. Please. Okay, so I'm going to skip Shabbos. Basically, I'll tell you what I have in my outline, and I'm more than happy to talk to you, to any person one-on-one about this, but I talk about Shabbos on or off campus, how to recruit, preparation tips. I don't have children, but the other couple that we work with on campus does, and they found to be very successful. They have a personal meal first. They have a meal with their kids first, and then have the meal with students. So the kids have eaten. They've had a good Shabbos meal. That's, you know, the way the Shabbos that they want to create for their kids, and then their kids will do something later while the students are having meals, so they are able to concentrate on both. Then we have a Shabbos intern, a student who's a Shabbos intern. We found that to be so helpful. She gets a lot of credit. We thank her every week, and she loves coming.
It's the same girl every week.
This happens to be a girl who's became Shomer Shabbos through us, or Hashem. I hate saying that I made someone. I never say that. Hashem gave me the blessing to be the shaliach to allow her to connect to Shabbos. So she's Shomer Shabbos, and she's on campus, and she's, what is she going to do? She's lost. This was a perfect match. She now has a purpose to be on campus. She's our Shabbos intern, and she was amazing, and we gave her a lot of public credit and a small gift at the end. She comes early to help set up. She is up clearing before I am, and she helps stay late to clean. We usually have a student intern at least one, sometimes two, every semester that shops for us before Maimonides, that helps set up Maimonides and clear Maimonides. Sometimes students need an internship as part of like an honors program, and this is something you can do, and then they do, I tell them you're going to do grunt work, but then I also empower them to do a volunteer effort if they want, other things like that. But we use students, and it's the only downside is using a from student that thinks that she can do kibbutz. That's the only issue that we've had. That one issue was a serious issue. Other than that, especially it gives students like this really self-esteem and a purpose and a place. Meaning, I think they're doing us a greater tova, but we are also giving them, you know, we're also giving them a great opportunity. Nope.
Nothing.
We don't pay them. We give them a gift at the end. We give them a lot of public credit, but they get self-esteem and a place on campus. And for some students that are a little more socially awkward, they get a whole social group through this. Because after the meal, they hang out with everybody. So they get a whole social group because of this. And they love that. And the students embrace them because they're a little socially awkward, but they're awesome girls. Now, you have to be careful. Don't have your intern be very, very socially awkward. Obviously, I'm just saying, like, a little not with the super in-cool crowd. Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it. A little more shy, exactly. Okay, alternative programs, because this is something I'm super passionate about. I work very hard to get students off campus. The growth that can happen off campus is key. So one thing I do is social outings. These can be on the spur of the moment. I call a bunch of girls. We have a kosher frozen yogurt place by us. Let's go to this kosher frozen yogurt place. And then what ends up happening is they say, Bill, I really want to go shopping with you. Sneeze shopping happens naturally. I never ask them to do it, ever, but it very often happens naturally. One thing that we've done very successfully is, because there are girls that do want to become martinias but don't have the money, is we have people in the community donate their old clothing, and we have a clothes drive, and we tell the students we charge them depending $3 to $5 per thing, and this is going as a donation to somewhere in Israel or some good cause. So they're feeling, not that they're, they don't have the money to buy Tznias clothing, they feel like they're actually doing a mitzvah by helping someone. We found that to be very successful, and these girls are now walking around in Tznias clothing that they had to pay very little money for. I've had at least four girls that have become almost completely Tznias through that. I found that to be very successful. I do all girls. I am a huge fan of all girls programming. I have had no problem with this, except for the boys complain why they don't have boys only programming, which
I thought they were complaining that they weren't with the girls.
Yeah,
that's what we.
They don't complain about that. They just want all boys programming. The girls, there might be a girl who the first thing is like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, I don't love the fact that it's all girls. By the end, they're like, Bela, can we only do this? And it gives them an opportunity to not have to worry about the way they look or sound or everything else. You know that. So I do an all-girls Shabbaton in New York. It's a whole weekend. It is a highlight of the semester for the girls. Every time it is Move Girls in ways that I've never, ever seen done before. We go up to Far Rockaway. They pay for a student ticket to a Broadway show. That they pay $50. That's all they pay to get to a Broadway show. Motzei Shabbos, we go into Manhattan. They make a candle or paint pottery, whatever it is. And the oneg is always spectacular. One thing that I want to mention before that I didn't. One thing that I think is very important is that we have to accept that students will reject us. Whenever I go into a relationship, I and this is the hardest part for me, is I say I have to love the student unconditionally. At any point, they will stab me in the back and say bad things about me. And it's not because of me. It's because of rather than saying, I'm not strong enough to do this, it's much easier to say, Bela is, fill in the blank, pushy, speaks badly about people, whatever it is. I don't do any of it. But I have had girls call up sobbing a year later and apologizing and saying, I've realized it's not me, it's you. I've had girl, this was very significant to me, a girl once at this all-girls Shabbos Oneg said, sobbing, she's like, Bela, when a girl pulls away, I know it's not me. There's something happening with them. So she was very involved. Shomer Shabbos, kosher for a little while. She had a difficult personal experience. And then she kind of disappeared. And she sat at this own egg sobbing. She's like, Bela, the reason that I am afraid to talk to you is because you're the only one that sees me. No one else sees me. You see me, and that scares me. But to me, that was such a significant message that when they're pulling back, it's not because they don't like us, even though that's what they're saying. It's because of their own issues. And once I've accepted that, it has freed me to help girls in a way I never, ever, ever could before. I think that's very important to kind of just accept that is going to happen. And as I said, I've had girls call and apologize years later, and sometimes it's an emotional issue and it just gives me a flag. They're depressed, there's something else, let me look into this. One thing that I'm launching on campus, I do spring break trips to Los Angeles. I love it. It's phenomenal. It's all girls. My husband does an all boys. It moves people like nothing else. One new program I offered anyone who wants to go to lunch, I said that they could.
All right, ladies. I'm just not holding them hostage. There's some incredible jewelry to see also, so don't forget to look.
Yeah, Dazzy Brown.
These trips sound like they're going to be quite expensive. Like from Baltimore to LA, I'm assuming that's.
Baltimore to LA? So this is how we do it.
Like the cost of the trip.
So this is how we do it.
Like we have the kids going in. They're expensive, and really the only way to kind of get them is to make them so cheap that it's almost not affordable to run them. So
this is how we do it now. I will not say that we're not in debt.
Right.
But, like every other, or not yet, but this is how we do it. They pay $1,500 for an alternative spring break trip through Hillel to go and paint houses. They do that.
Richard?
No. But they do that. They will pay $1,500. Personally, I this is something I struggle with. I think we make things too cheap for them. I hate the name Birthright. It's not your birthright to go to Israel. People died so that you can go there, and people are paying so that you can go there. I think our college students are way too spoiled, personally. So I will charge them airfare to go to LA, so that's about $399, and for students that can't pay, I will then drop it down. I then will say, and then we stay in people's gorgeous homes in LA. Activities are free. We go to the beach and picnic, and all I pay for is food and maybe a manicure for each of them. And and that's it. And then I say, if you want to do extra things, like go to the zoo or whatever else, you pay for yourself. So I'm paying for the rental van, and I'm paying for the food. I'm not paying for housing. They're staying in better housing. They're staying in these gorgeous guest homes that are nicer than hotels, and they're paying for their airfare. I don't find it to be. And there
is. What about New York, when you go to New York?
And when we go to New York, we pay for the van. Sorry?
Is that through JFI? New York? Farrakway?
No. We've been going to Farrakway, doing Shepperton's Farrakway for 9 years.
Oh.
So we just kind of do it through ourselves. Sure, Yasha helps, and they're an amazing community, but we've just been doing it so long. We just have our families and whatever else. But to New York, we pay for the van. The parking is expensive. My husband is the chauffeur. He just drives us around and sits in the van while we do it. And honestly, it's the greatest message to girls that my husband, who's a rabbi and teaches, is willing to chauffeur them around and sit in the van while they go and do things.
Oppressed in their
exactly. I joke around that I disagree with him in public just to prove that. I can. But anyway, so they pay the $50 for the Broadway show, and I tell them, which is true, I get them the student discount group, and they see Wicked for $50. They're thrilled. The expensive part is we get them pizza, Motzei Shabbos, it's the van, it's the gas, and we take them out to make, it's $25 a person at this place that I found that gives us a discount, and they can make pottery or a candle. For campus people, for people that have creative ideas, I have found that there can be funding. If you call up with a new idea that someone else hasn't had, or even if someone else has had, but that you're doing at your campus that's innovative, it's not a lot of money, but we will get $50 a girl to go to New York, which helps. And I usually will get, let's say, 25 girls to go to New York for Shabbos. I drive.
Sorry.
Yeah, I offer them, I'm not holding them hostage. I offer them to eat lunch if they want. So anyone can leave at any point. The last thing I'm going to talk about, and if anyone wants to continue to talk about Israel programs, alternative, like seminaries, like different types of seminaries, what type of student to send based on what people, my experience, and suggestions of other women who send people to seminaries, and then U.S. programs, Heritage and Sinai, and then also typical blockages that prevent people from becoming from. That's like the last thing. This is the first time I'm doing it, so I will now know to shorten the beginning. So this is one thing that I feel very passionate about because I'm starting a new program. It's called JWAI, Jewish Women Empowerment Initiative. I have found that girls are taken advantage of in every way on campus by the boys and by the system. If any of you are interested in reading a book that's going to get you really angry, it's called Unprotected by Dr. Miriam Grossman. You can read Unhooked. You can read... I hate the title of the book. It's called Pornland, but it's about the objectification of women in our society. She studied sexuality. I don't know if it's going to help. She studied sexuality on campus secretly and wrote a whole book, and it's all about how women are objectified and used, not only by the boys, but by the health professionals and the therapists on campus who encourage casual relationships. So this is a new approach that I'm taking after I read these books and got really angry, and I channeled that anger hopefully into something positive. And so instead of taught, and this is a great way, again, to introduce SNEAS, basically to empower women to have positive self-esteem and to make choices that they feel comfortable with. One brief story, I had a group of students, it was about 2 years ago, 5 or 6 best friends. Something must have happened because within a period of about 2 months, each one came to me separately and said, Bela, you guys have promised me that this is completely confidential, which obviously everything is, but it made them feel better saying that. And I don't feel comfortable drinking and having casual relationships, but I can't share this with my best friends. They will never understand. Every single one of these best friends came and said that to me within a period of 2 months. So what I said to them is, well, you might just want to try to have a conversation and see how it goes. And they all came back to me like, woo! wow! I was like, wow! Because I had to be surprised. Yeah? So most women feel this way. They just don't feel comfortable saying it because they think they're weird. So JWAI, Jewish Women Empowerment Initiative, has the following three components. One is, which I've done this past semester, we're just packaging it differently. It's Benot Note, which is short for Benot Mitak Note, the girl that is, and this is all student-run. I picked a student to run each of it, and once I empower the students, they're bringing in all their friends. This area I did last semester, and it was super successful. Basically, it's just volunteer and social action. A lot of things we do, we send to Israel. Quilting for Israel, making headbands for girls in Israeli orphanages, victims of terror, things like that, some local things. So that's a volunteer component. The other one, which is my personal favorite, and I have two girls who are running it. I have to check it off, but I'm empowering them to run it, is the Women Empowerment and Initiative area. One thing that I'm doing, which I love, I've done it before, it's been amazing, it's called the Inside Outside Box. It's an awesome way to introduce tzniut. Everyone gets a shoe box, and you get tons and tons and tons and tons of magazines. And every girl cuts out pictures and words from the magazines and puts it on the inside of the box, who she really is on the inside, on the outside of the box, who she portrays herself to the world. And that is an awesome way to introduce tzniut, totally non-threatening. The goal of tzniut is your inside should be like your outside. I found girls to really like that. Another thing is using Post Secret. Has everyone heard of Post Secret? Okay, Post Secret is this huge movement. It's become huge on college campuses and young professionals. It started as a website where anyone could post anonymously a secret. And other people could respond. So people post very, 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 very personal things. For the first time, everyone can respond. It's turned into conventions and huge things. So we're going to do a Post Secret. I'm going to call it something else, but I'm describing it as Post Secret so the girls know what it basically is. Also was really successful. I brought in a group of about 30 women. Everyone wrote a secret and put it in a bag. I pulled it out. One would be, I feel fat and ugly and unattractive. And then the other girls have a chance to respond. So another girl will stand up and say, I don't know who you are in this room, but everyone in this room, you are all beautiful, gorgeous women. And they all end up crying and loving each other and building a community. It's awesome. And then the final thing is, just like typical, challah baking and cooking classes, and this is from Tamar Livingston. She does something called the Chicken Soup Squad. She has students make chicken soup, package it in little frozen small containers. She has a magnet. You can call the Chicken Soup Squad at any time if you're sick, and they will deliver soup to your door. Okay, so I'll end there, and if anyone is interested in talking more about also the typical blockages, and then the final one is questions and issues about tzniut on campus, which I think is very important, how to answer questions about women in Judaism, abortion, birth control, gay marriage, and avoid politics in every way possible. So if anyone's interested in talking about anything on the sheet that I didn't talk about, then I'm happy to talk to anyone one-on-one, and I'd love feedback from you about if I'm doing this again, and I only have an hour and a half, what I should not talk about so that I can get through everything. Thank you.
You just need more than an hour and a half.
Yeah.
No, they all